We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we are very glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have as our guests for this hour of the show, Dr. Paul Epstein and also Dan Ferber. Paul Epstein is Associate Director of the Center for Health and Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. He is a doctor physician who is trained in tropical health. Dan Ferber is contributing correspondent for Science magazine. His feature articles have appeared in many places, Popular Science, Audubon, Nature Conservancy. They are the co-authors of a recent book that's titled Changing Planet, Changing Health. The subtitle is How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. The book is published by the University of California Press, is recently out, and looks at a number of ways in which climate change looks like it is affecting human health. Infectious disease, for example, is one area. Asthma is another. And also, it takes a look at agricultural production, something that we'll be talking about as it is based on research that has been done, is being done here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. As we talk, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask is that people try to keep their questions brief so we can get in as many callers as possible, but certainly questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you can also write us an email if you'd like to send your question that way. That's will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. Joining us here by telephone, Dr. Paul Epstein. Dr. Epstein, hello.
David.
Glad to have you with us. And here in the studio with me is Dan Ferber. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here.
Maybe just I'll start with Dr. Epstein. I understand that this is something that you have been interested in professionally speaking, maybe since the mid-1970s when you did some work in Africa where you were looking at cholera. Maybe you can just talk a little bit about how it is that that was the beginning of your interest in this larger issue of climate and health.
Sure. I was working in Mozambique as a physician, along with my wife, who's a nurse, and our two children living and working in Mozambique. And about a month after we got there, we were struck with one man brought in from the countryside with his eyes sunken and his skin tinting, and it was a classic picture of cholera. We set up rehydration units and trained people and brought the epidemic under control. But frankly, at that point, we hadn't a clue where this was from, because we thought a traveler may have brought it in, introducing it into the water supply. It really wasn't until several years later that I started thinking about the marine environment and the plankton, and then actually about 10 years later that the work of Rita Caldwell, who showed that there was a hibernating form of cholera that hid out in the plankton, the vegetables of the sea, as Rachel Carson calls them, the phytoplankton, zooplankton, that's the plant plankton and the animal plankton, and that those plankton communities were responsive to climate signals. So that's what really, it took about a decade to string this story together.
And maybe Dan can talk a little bit more about this. Maybe people will know at least a little bit about cholera and will understand that, or will have this understanding that it's related to sanitation issues. And it's something that's people spread, and it happens because water and waste isn't handled the way you don't, they're not kept separate the way that it should. But this is a different sort of approach to this idea that, well, the reason that it waxes and wanes is that it may indeed be the bacterium that causes it has a place that it, in between outbreaks, it goes and hides out.
Absolutely. And this is the result, this is the work of Rita Caldwell, who is a former director of the National Science Foundation, made these discoveries. What happens to cholera between outbreaks? It only happens every X number of years. So what she discovered is that it hides out in the ocean, and because when the ocean warms, that it helps foster this cholera bacteria, which rides on the plankton into inland waters, in particular in Bangladesh, where she was doing her work, and that triggered series of outbreaks. Also, the storms brought the bacteria on the plankton inland, and that caused that triggered the outbreaks. Mm. So as the climate warms, we get warmer coastal oceans, we get the storms. So it tied in the warming water. So it was a clue that a global change might affect an infectious disease.
And I guess there are also some other examples where, in one of the sections in the book, takes a look at the marine environment, the health of the marine environment. Particularly, we're talking about coastal waters, the ones right near the land, and about the fact that we have seen these increases in problems there, things like algal blooms and red tide, and that indeed have impacts on human health that are also related to warming.
Yes, and here we really took a broader view of health, and the health of the marine and the coastal marine environment is something that's threatened by some of the agents, the bacteria, the viruses, and so on. And so actually in the mid-90s, we put together about 100 people, to ornithologists and ichthyologists, fish specialists, birds, and so on, looking at disease across these wide taxonomic groups of birds, of sea urchins, of seagrass, of mammals, of turtles, as well as outbreaks in humans. And it was that big database and the maps that we put together that gave us a sense of where things clustered in terms of local areas, but also where they clustered over time. And it looked as if years with extreme weather events, particularly El Nino events, were associated with all of these issues, harmful algal blooms all the way through the invertebrates and coral and so on. So this has been a definite interest of ours, to look at the health of other organisms and how that ultimately affects human health.
And one of the ways that this can affect human health is via the red tides. Red tides can cause a lot of gastrointestinal problems, neurological problems. We talk in Changing Planet, Changing Health. We talk about a type. This is actually not a red tide. It's a different type of harmful algal bloom, but it actually caused amnesia in a lot of people permanently. Mm-hmm. It was a neurotoxin. Affects the nerve cells in the brain. So there's fish poisoning in the tropics from some of these. So if you change the balance of in the oceans, you can affect human health directly via these harmful algal blooms.
Yeah. And I think do I remember this right, that not only can these things be a problem if people eat seafood that's contaminated, but there are even air quality issues, that even if you happen to be walking on the beach, you can pick up toxins that way.
Yeah, that was a really amazing fact that I came across. I mean, already in Florida during these red tides, there's a higher rate of emergency room visits, and the lifeguards wear masks because some of these toxins they're in the sea spray, and they affect people.
Yeah. Let me very quickly introduce again the guest for this part of Focus. Here in the studio with me is Dan Ferber. He is a science writer, contributing correspondent for Science magazine. His work has appeared in many places: Popular Science, Audubon, Nature Conservancy. On the phone with us is Dr. Paul Epstein. He is associate director of the Center for Health and Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. He's a physician trained in tropical health, and they are together the co-authors of the book Changing Planet, Changing Health, which takes a look at the relationship between global climate change and global warming and human health, and it is published by the University of California Press. I want to mention just real quick, I'll give you some details later, but I do want to mention that the guest that we have here in studio with us, Dan Ferber, is going to be making a few appearances in Champaign-Urbana, a couple today and one tomorrow. And I'm assuming that anybody who is interested should feel welcome.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. It'll be a really interesting conversation.
All right. So, well, I'll give you the details on that later. And, of course, if you're interested in reading Changing Planet, Changing Health, you can seek it out at the bookstore. And questions here on the program are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email is will-talk@illinois.edu. I was thinking about something Dr. Epstein, you were just saying about being able to pull together data over time coming from different places. I guess the thing that strikes me is that this is one of the cases where now being able to use computers to put together large data sets to gather that kind of information together and look at how things are connected. This is the kind of thing that in the past, I think probably it would have been very difficult to actually do this.
It's true, and we call these systems geographic information systems, which are basically maps with overlays of various sets of data. Computers help, but some of this can be done in a very simplistic way. For instance, we looked at the mountainous areas across the globe, and mountains are great places to study climate change because of their verticality. You can go from desert to tropics to icy Arctic conditions in 5 or 6 miles. And we've seen three sets of data change. We've seen plant communities migrating upward and mapping those in Central Africa and Asia and Latin America and Europe. We've seen glaciers retreating, and then mosquitoes circulating at higher altitudes. And it's this confluence of three sets of data along with the temperature data, which gives us a real strong fingerprint of climate change and demonstrates not just the mosquito change, but how this is affecting the whole environment in mountainous areas. Mm-hmm. And that's a real laboratory for what's happening in terms of latitude. Little changes in mountains can represent vast changes in terms of latitude, northern, southern movement of disease vectors. Mm.
Well, here this gives us an opportunity to move it yet into another subject, then. It is insect-borne disease, and certainly we know that there are a number of diseases that are spread by mosquitoes, and the fact is that small changes in temperature can make a big difference, and maybe Dan could talk some more about that.
Absolutely, and to tell this story and to find out more about it, I visited Kenya. I visited the Mount Kenya region in central Kenya, and I traveled around there with a malaria biologist named Andrew Githeko, who's been investigating malaria spread in the highlands of Kenya. And one of the things that he had found was that it had warmed. Well, biologists have known for a long time. They know a lot about the malaria parasite. They know a lot about the mosquito. They know that, as you said, small temperature changes make a big difference, just 1 or 2 degrees Celsius, so 2 to 3, 4 degrees Fahrenheit. It has warmed that much in those areas, in these highland areas of East Africa. And as a result, the mosquitoes that carry malaria have moved into these areas. That's what we knew when I visited in 2008, and Dr. Githeko and I traveled around that area, and we visited some clinics, hospitals. We talked to school nurses. His goal was to find out, was malaria already on the ground there? And in fact, they were dealing with it. It was all over the place. So one of the things that happens in these outlying areas is that the people are very vulnerable to malaria because they haven't been exposed. In the low-lying areas of sub-Saharan Africa, malaria is all over the place. People get exposed as kids, and if you live through it, you end up being more like the flu later on. But in these highland areas, you get these waves of epidemics sweeping through that might get half the people in a village sick and kill hundreds of people. So the people in these areas, it's like the Native Americans when smallpox came in. They are very vulnerable to this disease, and so it is moving into these areas.
Yeah.
Could I pick up on this and just bring it a little closer to home?
Yeah,
well,
please, yes.
Clearly, malaria is the number one vector-borne disease in the world that we're concerned about. But in the U.S., it's tick-borne Lyme disease that's the main vector-borne disease. And we've seen some enormous change. This was discovered in Lyme, Connecticut, L-Y-M-E, in about 1976. And since then, it's spread in various ways, but it's spread even faster than the models predict. And we've seen an 8-fold increase in New Hampshire over the last decade of case reports, 10-fold in Maine, and movement up towards the Canadian border. And our models are based on average temperatures, but in fact, the winter temperatures have been going up dramatically, twice as fast as overall warming. And more as you get towards the poles, the warming is also greater. So indeed, some of these biological indicators, some of the diseases carried by vectors, are leaping up north or higher in the mountains even faster than we predicted with our models.
So, and in this particular case, it's because the tick that carries the disease is able to, because the winters are not as cold, it's able to survive the winter and at further north than it had before?
Exactly. Now, this is not a linear issue. We're all well aware of these wild winters we've been having the last two winters, and in some senses they are good for public health because they can push back some of these vectors. But it actually brings up a whole other issue of the winter weather instability and how that's related to our health.
Just to return to malaria just for a moment, I wanted to ask you, Dr. Epstein, because there certainly was a time when we had malaria in the United States, and it has essentially been eradicated. Is there any concern, though, that it's possible that we might start to see malaria in the United States again?
Well, we had some very small, locally transmitted outbreaks in the last several decades. But we do a great job here of controlling mosquito populations. About to visit this afternoon, the mosquito control unit for this area in the Northeast, and they use sprays that are innocuous. Bacillus thuringiensis, israeliensis is an innocuous larvicide that obviates the need to spray much later in the summer for things like malaria or dengue fever or West Nile or Eastern equine. So I don't foresee large outbreaks in developed countries. It's the ticks which are less amenable to treatment. And then, as Dan did a wonderful job investigating, the forest pests, the forest beetles that are armamentarium of pesticides and so on, is really weak at controlling. So it's these undersides of the issues rather than the direct impacts that may have the longest and most profound effect on our health.
Well, yeah, you want to talk about that for a minute, because here what we're talking about, these are not insects that attack people. These are insects that attack trees.
Absolutely, yes. These are they're called bark beetles, and they have naturally existed in the West for a long time and kind of have a balance of power with the pine trees out there. But at higher elevations, the pine trees that live at those elevations, they have no defenses against these bark beetles. So what's happening, the Rocky Mountains have warmed twice as much as the country on average. So they're a laboratory for what's happening with climate change in this country. And I visited Yellowstone National Park with a forest biologist named Jesse Logan. We climbed a mountain out there. We went up to the top of the mountain, and we looked over, and we saw a devastated whitebark pine forest. This is happening all through the high altitudes in the western United States. These forests are essential for wildlife. They provide cover for the grizzly bear, for elk, and they're just getting hit very, very hard. The connection with climate change is, again, these insects doing better as it gets a little bit warmer. And when you combine what else is happening out there, it's getting warmer, it's getting drier in the West. What you end up with is you're turning forests into tinder, and then you get forest fires, big forest fires. They are getting bigger in the West, and that is affecting the health of a lot of people because where you have fire, you have smoke, and that's a big air pollution problem that affects the health of a lot of people.
Yeah. Just to underscore one point here, I guess I'm struck by when you talk about these insects and the conditions under which they do well, that it doesn't take a big increase in temperature for them to increase their range. So whether you're talking about bark beetles or you're talking about deer ticks or you're talking about mosquitoes, it doesn't have to be 3, 4, 5 degree change.
That's true. And just to make it clear, the bark beetles are natural to forests. They help recycle nutrients and so on. But climate change has upset the balance. And the little bit of warming and lack of killing frosts has allowed them to overwinter, move to higher latitudes, higher altitudes, and even sneak in more generations each year. And as Dan mentioned, the drought and the heat waves dries the rosin in the trees that drowns the beetles as they try to drive through the bark. So it's the extremes that weaken the host, in this case the trees, and it's the temperature change that emboldens the pests.
Interestingly, Jesse Logan, who was the forest biologist I traveled with out there, he came up with a computer model that predicted that these bark beetles would take over the high altitudes in the early mid-90s, and they didn't in the high altitudes in Idaho until about 2003. He went back there and checked every year or two, and they were fine. The forests were fine. And then about 2003, they went over the edge, and he saw a big sea of rust-colored trees, which is the indicator of a bark beetle infestation. And so now you have – I saw it, too, when I was out there, huge forest infested. Yeah.
We will talk some more with our guests, Dan Ferber and Dr. Paul Epstein, in just a moment. We'd like to take a moment, though, to remind you that this station is listener-supported, and this is our spring membership campaign. We just got things started, and we're here to, in addition to having our show, to try to make sure that the shows that you enjoy and that you think are important, and I hope that you think Focus is one of them, we're here to make sure that these shows continue to be here on the station. That's the ultimate goal here, and what we hope that we will do over the next week is to hear from 1,000 folks who are willing to support the station with their dollars. And it's real easy. You can do it now. You can call. You can go online. Either way, it's real important. 244-9455 is the number to call. And here in studio with me is Dave Teal. He is the program director for WILL-TV.
Good morning.
Hey.
It's great to be here. And, you know, I'm only an occasional visitor to this studio. I've hosted a handful of episodes over the years and occasionally sat in on pledge drives like this one. And, I mean, I have at least some small appreciation for the amount of commitment that goes into producing this program. You know, 2 hours of talk every day about a wide, wide variety of topics. And, I mean, you know, David Engier, you know, has to know a little bit about a lot of stuff, maybe a lot about a little stuff, but, you know, but certainly has to be, you know, knowledgeable enough to ask thoughtful questions on all of these topics. And so, I mean, as I said, it's a lot of commitment. What we're asking for from you this morning is a little bit of commitment to commit, you know, making a contribution to this station and making sure that David is able to continue with this program and to be able to keep bringing all these interesting guests into the studio. The number to call, of course, is 244-9455. And, of course, a lot of you may be listening online, so, you know, consider giving that pledge at willpledge.org right now.
Yeah. Well, the key thing, I think, is the guests. What we try to do over the years is find guests who were knowledgeable and who were good at presenting the subject matter and putting them here and giving people a chance to call and ask questions, whether they agree with them or whether they would like to challenge them. Either way, that's great. And we've been doing the show now for 30 years. This is our 30th year.
It's really
and
amazing.
I did a back of the envelope calculation and figured that I had to do upwards of 12,000 interviews over the time that the show was on. So, yeah, you'd think I should have learned something by now. But the important thing is that the guests know. I just ask questions. They're the ones to have to come up with the answers. And people tell us they appreciate the range and the kind of people that we have on the show. So the key thing is, though, we hope that people who listen and who say, yeah, it's a good show, and I've maybe learned a couple things, will also understand that their financial support is very important to keeping us going.
Yeah, that's it. And, we get some money from the federal and state governments and the university, but really the majority of the funding still comes from our listeners. And that's why it's so important to hear from you this morning.
All right. Well, we'll get back to our conversation here with our guests, and let me introduce them again. Joining us by telephone is Dr. Paul Epstein. He's Associate Director of the Center for Health and Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. He is a physician who is trained in tropical health. And here in the studio with me is Dan Ferber. He's a science writer, contributing correspondent for Science magazine. His work has appeared in many places, including Popular Science, Audubon, Nature Conservancy. He's a graduate of the University of Illinois, has a master's degree from the U of I, where he studied journalism. Also happens to have a PhD in biology from Johns Hopkins University. And let me just mention, as I did say earlier, that Dan will be giving a couple of talks. And if people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana would like to hear more from him or meet him, he'll be at the Biomedical Research Center at the Mills Breast Cancer Institute of Carl Cancer Center. That's on West University. That's today, 12:15. Then he'll also be at the Author's Corner at the U of I bookstore, and that will be 4 o'clock this afternoon, okay? Yep. And then also he'll be giving a major talk on the campus tomorrow night, 7 o'clock. This is at the Heritage Room at the College of Aces Library on South Goodwin in Urbana, talking about the climate crisis as a health crisis. And they're all open to the public, so
absolutely
anybody who would like to stop by is certainly welcome. And if you're interested in reading on the subject, the book you should look for has been co-authored by our two guests, Changing Planet, Changing Health, published by the University of California Press. Let me get back here to Dr. Epstein. We were talking a little bit earlier about insect-borne disease. Maybe just real quick, I want to touch on one more. And that's dengue fever. And I asked the question about, well, is it possible we might start to see malaria in the United States? And we're not really sure about that. But dengue is something actually has been on the increase. It's been taking off a lot of places. It's been moving up through Mexico. And there is some thinking that perhaps we might start seeing this in the southern U.S.?
Well, you're absolutely right. This is a major concern. It's carried by Aedes aegypti, but also another vector, Aedes albopictus, which is a fancy name for the Asian tiger mosquito that's prevalent in the U.S. all the way up to Chicago. Fortunately, not as competent a vector as the Aedes aegypti. But yes, we've seen movement up through Mexico over the last several decades, barking at our door. Clearly, we have better mosquito control. We have air conditioning. People can defend themselves, can eliminate breeding sites. So it's not an imminent danger for large outbreaks. On the other hand, we're seeing signs in Key West, for instance. There have been dengue fever outbreaks in the summer of 2009 and 2010. So this is something that we have to be on the alert for, the conditions conducive to transmission. Again, those are three key words. The conditions conducive to the transmission are changing in latitude and altitude, so we've got to keep our guard up.
And by the way, the outbreak in Key West was the first outbreak of dengue fever in 65 years in this country.
Wow.
Dengue fever, for our listeners who don't know, it's a viral disease. There's 4 types of dengue fever, and it's known as breakbone fever because it knocks the heck out of you and causes pain for 10 or 12, 14 days. And if one gets 2 different types of it in subsequent years, it can lead to something called dengue hemorrhagic fever and be lethal.
And again, earlier we were talking a little bit about malaria. That's an insect-borne disease. It's carried by mosquitoes. But dengue and malaria are actually carried by 2 different kinds of mosquitoes.
Indeed.
So it's not. So we're not just worried about one particular type of mosquito. You got to be concerned about more than one.
And there are others that we have to worry about that transmit West Nile disease and La Crosse encephalitis, Eastern equine encephalitis, that all seem to increase when there is weather instability and lots of variability. I should say also that the temperature changes and range impacts are one dimension of the infectious disease story. The other is the extreme weather events. And even in this country, we see after heavy rain events greater than 2 inches a day, rain events, we see waterborne disease outbreaks. And in many parts of the world, we see clusters of mosquito, rodent, waterborne diseases that follow flooding, and sometimes even drought is accompanied by things like dengue fever because people store water around their houses in Puerto Rico and that becomes a breeding site. So it's not just the temperature, it's the extremes that can also change the timing, intensity, location of outbreaks.
We don't have to go too far to have seen that. The outbreak of Cryptosporidium in Milwaukee in 1994 was because of heavy rains and runoff of a lot of manure which carried the Cryptosporidium spores. 400,000 people got sick from that outbreak of Cryptosporidium in Milwaukee that year, and about 100 people died. So these are – we have to take a lot of care to protect our water supply. It's in danger of being infected by – in some of these flooding – when flooding happens like that.
Yeah. I have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. This is someone who's listening in Effingham, so we'll go to our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, thanks, David. What a great show. A great program, I mean. Two things. The standing water and, of course, mosquitoes and other things. And one of your guests just mentioned rats. And I've been thinking along with the program about the plague, which was in the 15th century somewhere. You know, it was the Black Plague, they called it. If there could be a reemergence of that. And since we are live in cities now, to a great extent, the common sewer, both storm and sanitary, if those things are breeding grounds for things that your guests are talking about, thank you, and I'll ring off.
All right. Well, I don't know, Dr. Epstein, can you say anything about bubonic plague?
Goodness, that was a wide range of questions. We've seen rodent-borne disease in the U.S. Mm-hmm. actually emerge in 1993 in the Southwest, the Four Corners. It was a hantavirus, and it was an explosion of rodents because of drought, which reduced the predators, the owls, snakes, and coyotes, and the early rains that led to an upsurge, tenfold increase in their populations. We are seeing small outbreaks of plague as well. Fortunately, it's a bacteria that we can treat, so that has limited when we do see cases. We can be on the lookout. So I'm not really, that's not one of the things that keeps me up at night, a resurgence of the Black Plague, which was in the Middle Ages, as the caller said, as well as 500 AD, when it really took off in Europe and had major implications for populations. On the other hand, your caller mentioned standing water and sewers, and just to put that together, West Nile disease is carried by mosquitoes called Culex pipiens in this part of the country, other Culex. And they love the organic, rich material at the bottom of sewers and drains, catch basins, during when there's drought in spring. But, again, we can introduce larvicide that's a bacteria and limit that so that we don't have to spray large areas in August when heavy rains set off the 80s and other bridge factors that can carry the West Nile from animals to humans. So,
no, okay. I don't,
that's a concern.
One thing that I want to make sure that we talk about, which certainly is an issue that's tied to climate and human health, although not quite as direct as, say, something like insect-borne disease. And I want to make sure we talk about it because it has to do with agriculture, and that is a big industry here, and also because it has to do with research that has been done here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, which takes a look at the impact of warming on field crops. And this is something that I know that Dan has done some writing about, and it deals with in the book. And it has to do with, well, what happens if there's an increase in carbon dioxide? What's that mean for the things that we grow to eat?
Yeah, so the original idea, I mean, it's a great question. I mean, the original idea was plants love carbon dioxide. That's their food. They're going to grow faster. This was the idea before people actually went out and checked it. So the idea was we're going to green the earth, we're going to have higher crop yields. Well, here at the right here in Champaign-Urbana, there's an experimental setup. It's of global importance. What they do is it's called the soy phase setup, and they're able to grow the crops in the field, create the atmosphere that you would expect in 40 years or so if we keep doing what we're doing as far as burning fossil fuels, and see what happens. So because it's open to the atmosphere, all these insects can come in. Anything that would happen in the field on any farm, it can happen. The only difference is the atmosphere. And what they've found in this setup is that, surprise, the insects eat more of the soybean, and they cut back on crop yield dramatically. And so that was not expected, and it is surprising and a little disconcerting.
So just, now I'm really curious. Now how I don't know how much detail you want to go into, but how exactly do they do this to simulate in an open field?
It's really cool. I mean, you have a ring. There's a computer sensor in the middle. It senses the carbon dioxide levels, and it feeds back. And the ring of piping basically just pumps carbon dioxide into the air around through this whole plot. And they're able to, because it's finely tuned, to keep the levels pretty constant. So when you're out there, you hear pss, pss, pss. You know, it's pumping out. Now and then, and you can see the computer setup in the middle.
Yeah, and so any increase in yield that you might see was what they found was more than offset in terms of insect damage.
The boon that they expected was much less than it would have been. And I also want to add that insect infestations are not the only way that the climate change can affect crops. I mean, we also talk in the book about diseases like soybean rust, which are able to spread north because of the warming climate and extreme weather. You get more hailstorms and more drier conditions and more heat waves. So there was a statistic recently that 1 degree increase in global temperature can lower global crop yields by 10% because of all of these effects put together. So we've already seen a 1 degree increase. And I was just reading a paper last night that showed that the effects are detectable already on crop yields globally.
We have a caller here. Let's talk with them in Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'd like to go back to the pine beetle issue. I have two sons that live in Colorado, so I'm out there quite frequently, and I've seen the devastation on the lodgepole pine. So, for instance, from Dillon up to Steamboat, and especially around Dillon, you look on the mountainsides, and it looks like 100% of the lodgepole pine, they're dead. And so this is just not a tree here or there. It's just very dramatic and obvious to everybody. About 3 years ago, when I was in Steamboat Springs, I went to a one-day meeting. It was mainly forestry people, and they were discussing the pine beetles, what they could do. And one of the points I made was that the big surge in pine beetle damage is not new. And I forget, it was around 100 years ago, for example, when they have evidence of really large infestations of the pine beetles and a lot of damage. And so we don't just need climate change to cause it, I think would be my point. If we have a current period of, let's say, 5 years of somewhat higher temperature in the winters, and that can just be a natural cycle, that can trigger the pine beetles. And then number two, when they were explaining the current epidemic, they felt it was very important to note that the forest fires have been stopped, basically, out west. And as a result, the lodgepole pine stand is very uniform in age. And this leads to infestations and problems, and they thought that was another real important factor in explaining the pattern now. So I'll stop with that and see if your guests want to comment further. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
thank you.
Sure, absolutely. These are great points, and you know, what's happening with these infestations is complex, multiple causes. Climate change is part of it, and so are the factors that you're talking about. We're talking about the spread of the beetle in the very high altitudes. The reason that these beetles, and this is different from what's happening at the mid altitudes with lodgepole pine, we're talking about the high altitudes with whitebark pine. What's happening there, those trees never needed any defense against the beetles because the beetles would be killed off by these snaps of extreme cold of 40 degrees below zero for days and days on end every few winters. And that just doesn't happen anymore out there. So the winters don't kill them off. There is always this balance of power between the insects and the trees. As Dr. Epstein said before, the balance has been shifted. But yes, it is a natural cycle, and the natural cycle has been altered. As far as stopping forest fires, we talk in the book about a study that I'll give you the punchline is basically that it pins it on climate change because the snowpack is melting earlier. There's a lower snowpack. You have a longer fire season. So the increase in forest fires can be connected to the to climate change that way. Is there something to do with the Smokey the Bear theory where you have because we had the fire control for so many years? Yes, that's a factor. But at the higher elevations, they didn't burn that much in the first place. And maybe once every 100 years or so, they're burning more. That pinned it back on climate change. And that was a paper in Science about 5 years ago.
If I can weigh in, unless there's other callers, let me know, David.
If you want to comment, I do have somebody else, but I think we can get him in if you wanted to add something onto that, though.
Sure. The caller's question raises the whole issue of natural cycles versus climate change. And to understand weather today and the climate today, we have to say this is climate change and natural variability. It's a mixture. All of the ice ages and so on that came and went up until the 1900s were due to the orbital changes in the angle of the sun, the angle of the Earth towards the sun, the eccentricities, until we get to the 20th century. And there we can only explain the temperature changes and now this variability based on greenhouse gases that trap heat in the atmosphere. One last thing is that the connection between global warming and climate change is through the oceans. Since the 50s, the oceans have warmed 22 times as much as the atmosphere and continents. And it's that warming that's embedded and buried in this repository of the oceans that evaporates faster and creates temperature changes as well as the extreme weather events and the sea level rise that are all part of climate change.
We have one more caller, and I want to try to get them in here, and they are also in Urbana. I want to thank the last caller and go to line number two in Urbana. Hello. Yes?
Just on the relationship of temperature and crop yield, you were touching on that a moment ago, and even with some of the crops we consider as warm weather crops, such as corn, when the temperature exceeds about 95 degrees, corn begins to shut down. And when you get over 100 degrees, its yield is definitely impaired. Would you care to comment on this with other crops?
No, can you do that, Dan?
Sure, absolutely. I don't have the expertise to comment on all different crops. I can say that's absolutely right. One of the things I can say to that is that the number of days above 90 degrees and above 100 degrees is predicted to go up dramatically over the next 30 or 40 years in Illinois and because of the warming climate in this region. So we're talking about some numbers where you might have 70 days in the summer where it's above 90 degrees in 30, 40 years from now. So you have the idea where the climate of Illinois will become more like the climate of a much more southerly state, say Oklahoma. And this is actually work done here at the University of Illinois.
and that would probably impair yields. It's a tropical, neotropical plant, but it's not used to those extreme temperatures.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right.
All right. Well, I thank the caller. And we're just about the point where we're going to have to finish. Maybe we have a couple of minutes left. Let me just, I'll turn back to here to Dr. Epstein and ask you the question. Is there a particular thought that you'd like to leave folks with?
Sure, David. Thank you. The thought I'd like to leave the callers with is that we can do something about this. And the bad news is that the climate system is now unstable. The good news is that systems like stability, and if we back off these greenhouse gases and the felling of forests, we can allow the Earth to come to a new equilibrium. And we talk about a whole lot of healthy solutions in this book, some of the problems with some of the unhealthy solutions, but also propose a whole set of changes we could do in our cities and railways and the way we transport ourselves, and then talk about some of the economic drivers that could help set in motion this clean energy transformation.
One of the exciting things is that there is something for every one of us to do. We talk about in the book, there are a lot of things that individuals can do. Most powerfully with our houses and cars, drive more fuel-efficient cars, drive less, get an energy audit, weatherize your house, et cetera, but in the book, there's also some, you know, people who are stepping up. We tell stories, in fact, a couple right here in Champaign-Urbana stepping up a bit, putting in a geothermal heating system in their house that paid for itself in 7 years. Communities are taking leadership roles around the country. Chicago has been up in the forefront. Things like promoting bike lanes, planting 400,000 trees under Mayor Daley. I mean, the list goes on. Smart growth, building inward so people don't have to commute as far. And as Paul mentioned, some of the international policy we talk about in the book that we're promoting some changes to help people all over the world protect public health as the climate changes and preserve forests, which are the two key aspects we're talking about.
Well, if you would like to read more on this subject, here's the book to look for. It's titled Changing Planet, Changing Health. The subtitle is How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. And it is published by the University of California Press by our two guests, Dr. Paul Epstein. He is a physician. He's associate director of the Center for Health and Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. He's a physician who is trained in tropical health. Dr. Epstein, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David. A pleasure.
And here in studio with me is Dan Ferber. He's a science writer. He's a contributing correspondent for Science magazine. His work has appeared in a number of other places, Popular Science, Audubon, Nature Conservancy. And let me just mention two things, again, for people here in Champaign-Urbana. He'll be doing a talk and a signing at the Alina Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner. That's up on the second floor. And that will be today at 4 o'clock. Right, and then he'll also be giving a talk tomorrow night at 7 on the campus talking about the climate crisis as a health crisis, disease, disasters, and a path to resilience. And this will take place in the Heritage Room at the College of ACES Library on the campus. That's on South Goodwin. So both those things are open to the public.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be here this morning.